Hey everybody, and welcome back to I Just Want to Talk About the Bible. If this is your first time joining us, then welcome. I'm glad that you're here. My name is Christian Keeter, and I live in the southeast of the United States of America with my amazing, beautiful, godly wife, Lacey, and our two wonderful daughters, Felicity and Serenity. So today we are talking yet again about wisdom, and the angle that we're going to be approaching it from today is something that's very near and dear to my heart and something that the Lord, I really feel like, has been teaching me a lot recently. And this is going to be something that we've touched on in other episodes, but we're going to look at a specific passage of scripture that will hopefully illustrate what we're discussing today. One thing that I have been talking about a lot with the guy who disciples me, and something that I really feel like the Lord has been teaching me through him, is, like I've already mentioned, the importance of seeking the Lord's perspective. So yes, it's very important to ask the Lord for practical wisdom. Should I do this or should I do that? Should I make this decision or that decision? But that's only one facet of what it means to ask the Lord for wisdom. Also encapsulated in that idea is going to be the idea of asking him to help us to see our circumstances through his perspective, or just see things the way that he sees them. Something that, again, I want to give credit where credit is due, and so right now I'm drawing a lot on what I have learned through the guy who disciples me. But what I'm learning is that this is not just a one-time prayer, or even a sporadic prayer, Lord, help me see things the way that you see them, but it's supposed to be a daily prayer. It's supposed to be a recurring prayer, that whenever we're going through situations in life, just asking the Lord, Father, please help me to see this the way that you see it. Please show me. Please help me to have the proper perspective, because we have a very limited perspective. We are super nearsighted. We only typically acknowledge and look at the physical components of what's going on. And we can be completely blind to so many facets of it. So completely blind to what the Lord is doing through it, or just completely misread a circumstance entirely. And so this is something that I feel like the Lord has really been instructing me in as well. And so we're going to be in the Old Testament again today, 2 Kings chapter 6. Now, I recently heard a message taught by the leader of the ministry that I'm on staff with, Mentoring Men for the Master. He was giving a message, and in this message, he referenced this passage, and it just kind of really brought it back on my radar. And so I wanted to come back and, not that I'd forgotten about the passage, but it just got me, you know, thinking about it again. And I wanted to discuss it here on the podcast. And so it's going to be in 2 Kings chapter 6. This is going to be an incident from the life of Elisha, not to be confused with Elijah. Elisha was Elijah's protege. He was the prophet after Elijah. This takes place during the point in Israel's history, the divided kingdom. So previously there was a united kingdom under Saul and David, and then David's son Solomon. But then under Solomon's son Rehoboam, the kingdom was split. Not going to get into all the details about that. And there was the northern tribe referred to, the northern tribes, the northern kingdom known as Israel, and then the southern kingdom of Judah. So you have Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And this can actually be a difficult timeline to keep straight, because these are two kingdoms that run parallel to each other and they interact many times. And so 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles are going to be recording this time. And so when you see Israel, it's referring to the northern kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes that broke away. And then you have, when it says Judah, it's going to refer to the tribe of Judah in the south. And one important detail, the capital of Judah was Jerusalem, and the capital of Israel was Samaria. Now time is going to go by, and eventually the Assyrians are going to come and attack Israel down the line and lead them off into captivity. Then about a century and a half after that, Nebuchadnezzar is going to come with Babylon and do the same to Judah. And you can read, this is all in the Bible, and you can read all about that. But this is just in the time where the two kingdoms are running parallel to each other, before those attacks happen, before the Lord hands them over to their enemies because of their idolatry and so on. And one thing I'm going to do as well, in the description to this episode, I'll include the link to an article that talks about Elisha and gives a little bit more detail about who he was, so you can do that research on your own if you'd like and you're not familiar with him. But that's where we are in the biblical narrative. That's kind of where we are. And so 2 Kings chapter 6, let's see, beginning in, let's begin in verse 8. So it says, "Once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servants, saying, 'At such and such a place shall be my camp.'" So let's just pause there. So Syria, an opposing nation, is coming to attack Israel. And this is something that this would happen. In fact, if you go back to chapter 5, verse 2, it says, "Now the Syrians, on one of their raids, had carried off a little girl from the land of Israel, and she worked in the service of Naaman's wife." And Naaman was the commander of the army of the king of Syria. You can read about that in 2 Kings chapter 5. And so you see that this is not the first time this sort of thing has happened. We read a little bit about it back there in chapter 5. Here we are in chapter 6. So they're warring against Israel. And so I want to reread that. We're just going to keep going. "Once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servants, saying, 'At such and such a place shall be my camp.' But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, 'Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there.' And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him, so that he saved himself more than once or twice." So let's pause there just briefly. That was through verse 10. And so what's happening here? When it says the man of God refers to Elisha. That's who's being described here. And Elisha will be named later in this passage as well. So what's happening, though? So Syria is going to come. He's going to attack Israel, war against Israel. But Elisha would send word to the king of Israel. And what would he say? He would say, "Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there." He had this supernatural insight given by God. He was a prophet, and he was aware of the enemy's tactics and their strategies, what the Syrians were doing. And it says that this was not just a one-time thing. It says in verse 10, "And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him." So the king responded to what Elisha showed and made the necessary, took the necessary precautions and so on. And then it says, "Thus he used to warn him, so that he saved himself there more than once or twice." So this happened, it explicitly says, more than once or twice. And so the passage goes on, resuming in verse 11, "And the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, 'Will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel?' And one of his servants said, 'None, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom.' And he said, 'Go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him.' It was told him, 'Behold, he is in Dothan.' So he sent there horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city." And so that's through verse 14. So the king comes in, he calls in his servants, and he says, there's got to be a traitor among us, because how on earth does the king of Israel continue to know this? And so he's thinking, one of you guys, one of the servants here, you're giving the king of Israel this information. That's why he's able to keep evading me and taking the necessary precautions and so on and so forth. But one of the servants says, no, it's because of Elisha, the man of God. And I love what he even says. He says, "The prophet who is in Israel tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." So basically, it's as though the servant is saying to the king, he's reading your mail, king. He is able, like, there's no secret kept from him, like, as far as your plans. It says, "The words that you speak in your bedroom, this guy's telling to the king." And so obviously the point that this servant is making is just that it's this supernatural insight that Elisha has been given. And so it's this man of God. And so then what happens? They're going to go seize the prophet. It's like, okay, well, if this prophet Elisha is the one who's messing up our attempts to attack Israel and to raid against Israel, then, well, let's go take care of him. So they find out where he is. This place is Dothan. They send their horses and chariots. It's a great army. They get there by night and they surround the city. So this happens at night. So continuing on in verse 15, it says, "When the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city." So the man of God's servant, Elisha's servant, wakes up. He goes out, goes, you know, maybe for a morning walk, goes out and, you know, just maybe to admire the sunrise. But he steps outside the city and, there's an army with horses and chariots all around the city. Not what you want to do. You don't want to think about just think about this. You wake up one morning and you're like, you know what? Let's just see how it feels outside. You kind of go open the front door and all of a sudden you got about a dozen tanks surrounding your house. It's like, okay, that's not what I want to walk outside and see. You know, a bunch of like armed soldiers, tanks, just really heavy artillery, everything like waiting there for you to walk out the door. It's like, okay, that was not my plan for today. And so that was and then continuing in verse 15, it says, "And the servant said, 'Alas, my master, what shall we do?'" Okay, that's the end of verse 15. Great question. Side note, we should totally bring back the word alas. That's a wonderful word. So he says, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" Totally reasonable question. Totally reasonable response. And so he runs to, you know, back to his master Elisha and asks this. But listen to what Elisha says. Continuing in verse 16, he said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And so let's pause there. So the servant comes running back up. He says, "My master, you know, alas, my master, what shall we do?" And Elisha says this wonderful thing. He says, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then he prays. He prays that the Lord would open this guy's eyes. And the Lord does. And he sees the mountains are full of horses and chariots of fire. Which, by the way, if you're familiar with the story, you remember what carried up Elijah, Elisha's mentor, into heaven. It's chariots of fire. And so this is perhaps a little bit reminiscent of that, but you see that he sees that spiritually speaking, the spiritual armies of the Lord, you know, think of it like this. The city may be surrounded by this physical army, but this physical army is surrounded by the heavenly armies. And the heavenly army, obviously, is far larger. And so my point is this. That reality was already present. The heavenly army was already present. Elijah's prayer was just that this guy, his servant, could see it. You don't get any concern from Elijah. Elijah did not freak out at all in this whole process. He was very aware of what was going on. And even though the physical enemy was there, he was aware of what was going on spiritually. He had a very clear spiritual perspective in this circumstance. So this guy is seeing this. He's seeing this. Let's go through the passage some more. His spiritual eyes have been opened. And then there's kind of an interesting contrast that happens next. It says in verse 18 and continuing, it says, "And when the Syrians came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, 'Please strike this people with blindness.' So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha." And so let's pause there. That was verse 18. His servant's spiritual eyes were opened while the Syrians' physical eyes were closed. The servant's spirit, he began to see what was going on spiritually as well as physically. And the Syrians lost the ability to see even what was going on physically. Just kind of an interesting contrast there. Continuing on in verse 19, kind of gets a little comical. It says, "And Elisha said to them, 'This is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek.' And he led them to Samaria." So Elisha is the man whom they're seeking. And he's like, no, wrong city, sorry. Here, I'll take you to the guy you are seeking. And where does he take him? He takes him to Samaria, the very capital of Israel, the capital city, which is where the king is, by the way. So continuing in verse 20, it says, "As soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, 'O Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see.' So the Lord opened their eyes and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria." So that's verse 20. Uh-oh. So now they're right in the midst of Samaria. And the king of Israel, the king of Israel sounds like a kid here. He goes in verse 21, it says, "As soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, 'My father, shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down?'" That's verse 21. It says it twice. He's just like ready to go. He's like, "Oh, should I take him down? Should I take him out? We're ready. Let's get them. The Syrians, you've brought them to me." However, in verse 22, it continues, "He answered, 'You shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master.' So he prepared for them a great feast. And when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. and the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. So that's the end of the passage. That was through verse 23, the end of the passage we're going to be looking at. However, I do want to highlight something really quickly before we go back and explore this a little bit. In verse 24, which is the immediate next verse, it says, "Afterward, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, mustered his entire army and went up and besieged Samaria." So I just want to go ahead and acknowledge and hopefully address what could look like some sort of contradiction, because we don't want to ignore these things because we know that there are good explanations for it. And if there's something that looks like a contradiction, we realize that, no, this is not a contradiction. This is just something that requires a little bit more research, thought, study, and prayer. And so let me just, you know, I was actually doing a little bit of research on this right before I recorded this episode. And let me share with you just hopefully a helpful explanation, because you have in verse 23, it says, "And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel." And then the next verse says, "Afterward, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, mustered his entire army and went up and besieged Samaria." It's like, whoa, they got over that pretty quick. So much for not going on raids. Well, I want to hopefully provide something that will help here. So let me read this from the NASB. Yeah, I normally read out of the English Standard Version. Let me read you out of the New American Standard Bible real quick. Verse 23. It says, "So he provided a large feast for them, and when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master." Now listen to this. "And the marauding bands of the Arameans did not come again into the land of Israel." So, and then I'll even, you know, really quickly, the NIV says, "So the bands from Aram stopped raiding Israel's territory." And so this terminology of the marauding bands, or the band, the Hebrew word means a band, a troop, a marauding band, or a raiding band. And the English Standard Version definitely includes that, where it says they no longer, they did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. However, I think this is part of the key to understanding this. So let me just give you the definition here. We don't use the word maraud or marauder or marauding very frequently, but to maraud means to roam in search of things to steal or people to attack. And so the idea almost is this. The idea is that the Syrians would just kind of like roam through the land of Israel at times and just kind of attack and steal and just pillage in a manner of speaking, take the spoil. And going back to 2 Kings chapter 5, which I read a minute ago, you kind of get the feeling of that as well, where it says, Now the Syrians on one of their raids had carried off a little girl from the land of Israel, and she worked in the service of Naaman's wife. And so it says on one of their raids, it was almost like this is just something they did. And so it seems that these raids, this kind of marauding business, stopped. And what happens in the next verse, the one that we just read, when Ben-Hadad musters, it says his entire army and went up and besieged Samaria. That is a far cry from a marauding band. That's an all-out like attack, a war. They're being besieged. And so that I want to paint the difference here. This isn't kind of random skirmishes, which is kind of the picture of what was happening previously. Kind of going through the land, random skirmishes, and Elisha had been warning the king about what was going to happen. And this is a full-on war. And so it's not a contradiction. Just a little bit of study, again, answers a lot of questions. So, but returning to the passage, what's going on here? What are we even talking about? Why are we talking about 2 Kings 6, and how does this have to do with having the Lord's perspective? This is just one of the passages that comes to my mind when I think about, okay, I want to have my spiritual eyes opened. I think far too often I am like Elisha's servant, where I figuratively walk out of the city and I see the army surrounding the city. "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" And I say that in my own sort of ways. Our go-to is not ever to really interpret things spiritually. That is something that we learn. Our go-to is not to try to see things from God's perspective. Our go-to, our natural response, is just to respond immediately to the physical. And that's not a right response. And if we do that, we're going to be at the mercy of our circumstances. How we're doing is always going to be the mercy of our circumstances. When in reality, we should be praying a very similar prayer that Elisha prayed for his servant, which is, "Lord, open my eyes that I may see. Because I know that there's stuff going on spiritually in this circumstance that I'm not aware of. And so, Father, I ask, please open my eyes that I may see." That should become part of our praying. And since we're always going through new circumstances, since we, you know, there's always different armies, so to speak, surrounding the city, this prayer will change form a lot. There'll be a lot of, Lord, why did blank happen? Or why didn't blank happen? Or Lord, why this or why that? Help me to see this from your perspective. Help me to see this from your perspective. Because listen, when we start to see things from the Lord's perspective, it changes everything. A word from the Lord changes everything. And whereas we might have previously been feeling depressed or worn out or exhausted or irritated or angry or any sort of thing, when the Lord shifts our perspective, it changes so many things, including how we feel. And this may or may not mean that the circumstances changed. And yes, it's perfectly fine to pray that our circumstances change. However, part of our praying has to be, Lord, change my perspective as well. Help me to see things the way that you see them and help me to trust you. You know, back in, I talked a little bit in the previous episode about one of Israel's wilderness wanderings, the wanderings. When they started out, they were going from the Red Sea to Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb. And they had a few tests on the way there. They had three tests on the way from the Red Sea. They had, you can read about it in Exodus 15, 16, and 17. They have where they had gone days without finding any water. We've talked about this in another episode entitled Elim is Just Around the Corner. And they find water and it's undrinkable. They can't drink the water in Exodus 15. And they start to grumble. And they start to complain, and it says they grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And the Lord showed them, or showed Moses, a log, a piece of wood, a tree, and Moses tossed it into the water, and the water became drinkable. It changed from being bitter to sweet. And it says, there the Lord made for them a statute and a rule, and there he tested them. And that's in verse 25 of Exodus 15. If you go through Exodus 16, it's the whole passage about the manna, the bread from heaven. And then chapter 17 in Exodus talks about the water from the rock. And so there's all these felt needs that Israel has. There are all these real things, and they're going through their circumstances, and they're saying, oh no, we don't have water. Oh no, we don't have food. Oh no, we don't have water. And there are these real needs, but they grumble against Moses, and they complain, and they grumble, and they fail the test. They fail the test. And what would have caused them to pass the test? Well, in a word, trust would have caused them to pass the test if they had trusted the Lord instead of grumbling and complaining. But what was it that led them to grumble and complain? It was that they were only looking at their physical circumstances. And they had had this big, incredible, they had just seen the 10 plagues. They had just been led through the Red Sea. They had just been delivered from the hand of Pharaoh. And they were singing songs earlier, 3 days prior in Exodus 15, after they came out from the Red Sea. It was a time of celebration. And yet only 3 days later, they had seen God provide for them. They had seen him do incredible, incredible things. And now they're not trusting, and they're only looking at things from their physical perspective. And we can be quick to be harsh on them, but we do the exact same thing. We do the exact same thing. I'm often distressed and disturbed by even as I look at myself, where it's like I can have these wonderful times spiritually, or I feel like God is really showing me a whole lot. And then a few days can go by, and I can be like down in the dumps, and I can be really struggling, you know, and it's just like, well, where was everything that happened just a few days ago? It's like, has my trust so waned that I don't even know. It's kind of hard to even describe sometimes, but it's one of these things where it's like, if I just had a spiritual perspective as opposed to just a physical, then that would change so many things. And so I know this is true for us as well. And if we just have a physical perspective, then life seems chaotic. We don't understand why things are happening, why things aren't happening. We don't understand so much. But if we can accurately assess what's going on spiritually, then that changes everything. And we know that God gives wisdom to those who ask. This is a passage that I've referenced quite a bit. And I've referenced it a lot because the Lord has just really had me here a lot. Been teaching me a lot through it. But James 1, 5 and 6. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. That's the end of the passage. But he gives wisdom. We just have to ask. We have to acknowledge our lack. We have to ask. We have to believe that he'll give it. And so I just want to encourage you. I hope that these previous episodes have been very practical and helpful. you know, the episode 35, and I was talking about how we're having a little bit of a wisdom mini-series of sorts here, but let's talk about episode 32. Episode 32 talked about connecting the dots and seeing kind of what the Lord is doing in our circumstances and gleaning some wisdom that way. Episode 35, we talked about even if we've been in the same circumstance multiple times, we should still stop and seek the Lord to make sure that He wants us to handle it the same way that we handled it previously, or if He had some sort of different insight for us. Episode 36 talks about how we just need to, as we look at our life, ask the question of priority, which is, okay, what has God called me to do? And what can other people do? What are things that should be at the top of my priority list and things that should not be as high, even if they are good, because I don't want to neglect what's unique to me to do things that other people can do. And then today we're talking about this. We're talking about us seeing things from God's perspective. And so I just want these things to be kind of tools in the tool belt so that you can pull these things out as you're going through life, because we need wisdom. Oh my goodness, we need wisdom so bad, and I see my need for it more and more. But the wonderful thing is that as we continually beg and cry out to God for wisdom, we change as well. Again, if we just ask for wisdom one time and He gave it, boom, we're done. Okay, then we didn't really change very much. But if day by day, week by week, circumstance by circumstance, we are regularly asking God for wisdom, regularly acknowledging that we do not have wisdom, regularly acknowledging our dependence on Him, our lack of perspective and wisdom, and just how we need Him to work and how we need Him to open our eyes, that produces humility. Indeed, that very act in and of itself is a humble act. It's saying, God, I don't have all the answers and I need Your help. And listen, Christianity is a walk into deeper and deeper humility. You never outgrow humility. In fact, the entire Christian life begins with humility, because Jesus said, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. We never get to the point where we no longer need to be poor in spirit. On the contrary, the further we go, hopefully the more poor in spirit we become, the more we see that we need the Lord. But before wrapping up, let me give you one more example here. Matthew 16. This is when Jesus is walking with His disciples. This is actually right after Peter confesses Jesus as the Christ, as the Messiah. It's a great moment in the life of Peter. It really is. And we're going to begin in verse 21, 16, 21 through 23. It says, from that time, Jesus began to show His disciples that He must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And so that's verse 21 there. This is, Jesus knew full well of what was going to happen, obviously. He knows He's going to Jerusalem, He's going to die, He's going to be crucified, He's going to be buried, He's going to rise from the dead. And this is the whole, this is the central focus of the entire gospel. You know, Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 15 that if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then everything is in vain. And so Jesus is saying all of this again. And obviously Jesus is full well of everything that's going to happen. He says in the Gospel of John that no one takes his life from Him, but that He has the authority to lay it down and the authority to raise it back up. And so He's telling His disciples this. He tells them this actually multiple times. We're in chapter 16. Actually, in chapter 17, you can read this as well. It says, I'll just go ahead and read it, 22 and 23. It says, as they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill Him, and He will be raised on the third day. And they were greatly distressed. And so you have this, that's 22 and 23. So you can see how they're responding to this. They're greatly distressed, and which seems to imply to me that they're only listening to the first half of the equation, that He's going to be killed, but then the whole be raised on the third day. So going back to where we were, that's after the conversation that we're reading right now. But Jesus says what He said. It says, I'll read verse 21 of chapter 16 again, then we'll just read through the rest of the passage. It says, from that time, Jesus began to show His disciples that He must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took Him aside and began to rebuke Him, saying, far be it from You, Lord, this shall never happen to You. So we'll pause. So Peter's rebuking Jesus. That's very bold, Peter. Let's see what happens next. And then in verse 23 of chapter 16, it says, but He turned and said to Peter, get behind Me, Satan. You are a hindrance to Me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. And so here is a perspective thing as well. Peter comes up. Jesus tells Peter what's going to happen. And we know that this is the gospel. We understand, we dedicated an entire episode to exploring and hopefully explaining clearly the gospel, the central gospel message. And Peter is saying, no, you don't, no. Don't say that. You know, we don't, that's not the plan. It says, Jesus said, or Peter said to him, far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you, talking about his death. But Jesus came to die. He came to pay the price for our sins. We know that the wages of sin is death, but the free gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus our Lord. Romans 6:26, we know that his death, remember when he was on the cross, it ripped the veil in half from top to bottom, opening up access to the Lord, to the presence of God. I mean, we have in fact, I'll just go to Hebrews 10 real quick. Let me flip here. Hebrews 10:19 and following, it says, therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is through his flesh, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart, in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience, and our bodies washed with pure water. And so that's the end of that passage. We know that Jesus came to die. And so Peter had a very limited perspective. He was only thinking in terms, in physical terms. He wasn't seeing the big picture. He had a very limited scope. And he got pretty severely rebuked. And so we want to have the accurate assessment of what's going on. We want to ask God for his perspective. We don't want to do what Peter did. And this is what Peter did. Peter unintentionally was resisting the plan of God. And he didn't mean to do that. He thought he was like going to bat for Jesus. Be like, Lord, this will never happen to you. But I mean, he was unintentionally resisting the plan of God. And then what did Jesus say to him? He said, get behind me, Satan. He says, you are a hindrance to me. You're a hindrance. The Greek there is, you are a stumbling block. And so we see that Peter is completely opposing entirely the plan of God in this passage. And he didn't even know it. He thought he was doing the right thing. He was only seeing and thinking physically. And so that's just a New Testament example of, I think, the same principle. And so, but listen, this is something we all need. And I'm not going to continue to belabor the point, but I just want to encourage you to make it part of the daily rhythm of your prayer life with God, which you should have daily prayer times with God. There, without prayer, there's no power. Like you, the word and prayer, not either or, but both. And I know a lot of times it's easier just to read the Bible and not really dedicate as much time to prayer. At least it is for me, but we need both. But I just want you to incorporate into your daily praying, Lord, help me see things the way that you see them. I want to cooperate with you. I want to assess things the way that you do, but I can't do it by myself. So I hope this is encouraging and helpful as always. All right, until next time, God bless you guys.